A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been living with an architect and has picked up enough to realize that most of us have no idea what architects actually do. His wife, Hannah, thinks about spaces, about how they function, about how people move through them. And he's noticed something. Architecture, the way she practices it, sounds a lot closer to what we mean when we say architect in the colloquial sense. Someone who engineers a system, who designs how things work. Which raises a few questions. Where does architecture stop and urban planning begin? Is coordination between the two even happening? And is it fair to say architects are basically ergonomists, that their real job is engineering human welfare through space?
This is one of those questions where the popular answer is so wrong, it's almost a category error. If you ask someone what an architect does, they'll say, makes pretty buildings. And I get why. The profession's public face is the glossy render, the iconic skyline shot. But Hannah, like most practicing architects, probably spends maybe 10% of her time on aesthetics. The rest is code compliance, circulation studies, daylight analysis, acoustic modeling, fire egress, accessibility requirements. It's systems integration disguised as art.
My favorite part of this is that Daniel's essentially been osmosis, learning architecture for however many years, and his takeaway is, wait, this is actually a functional discipline, which tells you how thoroughly the profession has failed to communicate what it does.
It really has. And the American Institute of Architects defines architecture as the art and science of designing buildings and other physical structures. Everyone hears art. Nobody hears science. But the science is where the actual work lives. I think about this every time I see a movie where the architect character is just sketching moodily at a drafting table. Nobody shows the architect on a conference call with a mechanical engineer arguing about whether the duct run can squeeze through the beam pocket.
Or the architect sitting in a fluorescent-lit municipal office waiting to explain to a code reviewer why the stair landing meets the exception in section 1-1 dot. That's the real glamour.
It's not cinematic, but it's where buildings actually get made or broken.
Let's start with the obvious question. If architects aren't just making pretty buildings, what are they actually doing?
They're optimizing for human welfare at the scale of a room, a floor, a building. And the most concrete way to understand this is through the ergonomics lens. Ergonomics is the study of how humans interact with their environment. Reach distances, sight lines, thermal comfort, acoustic privacy, how long you can stand before you need to sit down. An architect designing the kitchen is calculating counter heights and the triangle between sink, stove, and refrigerator so you're not walking 12 miles to cook dinner. That's ergonomics. An architect positioning windows in a school classroom isn't just thinking about the view. They're optimizing for circadian rhythm, because daylight exposure at the right times of day improves student performance measurably.
You said measurably.
There's a 2023 study in the Health Environments Research and Design Journal that looked at hospital room layouts, specifically nurse station placement. The traditional model has a centralized nurse station serving a whole floor. The researchers found that switching to decentralized stations, one per 8 to 12 beds, reduced nurse walking distance by 40%. That's not a design flourish. That's an ergonomic intervention that changes how care gets delivered.
40% fewer steps means faster response times, fewer falls, fewer medication errors.
And patient satisfaction scores went up 15%. The architecture of that hospital floor is doing measurable work on human outcomes. And nobody walking through the lobby is thinking, wow, look at that nurse station placement. They're thinking about whether the atrium looks nice.
Which brings us to the ergonomist framing. If I'm an ergonomist designing an office chair, I'm thinking about lumbar support, seat depth, armrest height, how the chair adjusts to different bodies. If I'm an architect designing an office, I'm thinking about the same things at room scale. How the space adjusts to different work patterns, different team sizes, different times of day.
This isn't a new idea. The functionalist tradition in architecture has been making this argument for over a century. Louis Sullivan coined form follows function in 1896, and people quote it constantly while completely misunderstanding what he meant. He wasn't saying aesthetics don't matter. He was saying the shape of a building should express its purpose. That function drives form, not the other way around. The Bauhaus picked this up in the 1920s. Then, in 1977, Christopher Alexander published A Pattern Language, which is essentially 253 ergonomic heuristics for designing human-centered spaces.
253 patterns, from the scale of a region down to a window seat.
They're remarkably specific. Light on two sides of every room. 6-foot balcony. These aren't aesthetic preferences. They're observations about what makes spaces work for people. Alexander and his team didn't sit in a studio and invent these. They observed how people actually use spaces, what makes some rooms feel comfortable and others hostile, and they codified it.
Light on two sides of every room. I've lived in apartments with windows on one wall and apartments with windows on two. The difference is enormous, and you don't consciously notice it until someone points it out. That's ergonomics working invisibly.
Which is the highest compliment, honestly. Like a good user interface, you don't notice it's well designed, you just don't get frustrated. Bad architecture announces itself constantly. Good architecture disappears.
There's a building I used to work in where the elevator lobby was maybe 8 feet wide, and the elevator doors opened directly into this narrow corridor with the stair door on the opposite wall. Every morning, 40 people would spill out of two elevators into a space designed for maybe 6 people to pass through comfortably. You felt it every single day. That building was screaming at us.
Someone signed off on that. An architect drew that lobby, a contractor built it, and probably nobody ever did a simple circulation calculation for peak elevator discharge. That's not a failure of aesthetics, it's a failure of ergonomics. It's the equivalent of designing a chair with armrests that dig into your thighs. You don't notice good armrests, you absolutely notice bad ones.
Architects are ergonomists at the building scale. But you mentioned something earlier, the coordination problem. What's the architect actually responsible for integrating?
This is where the job gets genuinely complex. An architect has to coordinate structural engineering, mechanical systems, electrical, plumbing, acoustics, fire safety, accessibility compliance under the ADA, and increasingly sustainability requirements, all while maintaining spatial coherence. That's not drawing, that's systems integration.
Each of those systems has its own constraints that pull in different directions. The structural engineer wants columns in certain places. The mechanical engineer needs duct runs. The acoustics consultant wants certain wall assemblies. The architect has to make all of that work together in a space that still feels intentional.
Here's the thing. Architecture's jurisdiction technically ends at the property line, the building edge. But the building's performance doesn't stop there. Shadows, wind patterns, street activation, how the ground floor meets the sidewalk, all of that spills into the public realm. And that's where urban planning steps in.
The boundary between architecture and planning isn't a wall. It's a seam. And seams can be well stitched or they can fray.
Most of the time, they fray. Because urban planners work at the scale of districts and codes, zoning maps, comprehensive plans, 20-year horizons. Architects work at the scale of individual parcels, with 2 to 5 year project timelines. The planner is thinking about the whole city. The architect is thinking about one building. And when you have dozens of architects, each optimizing their own parcel without coordination, you get what I'd call death by a thousand cuts. Each building is fine on its own, but together they create wind tunnels, shadow canyons, dead ground floors.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. Except the wallpaper is actively making the street unpleasant to walk down.
This is where the ergonomics analogy scales up beautifully. If an architect is an ergonomist for a building, designing the chair, to use your analogy, then an urban planner is an ergonomist for the city. They're designing the room the chair sits in. And if those two ergonomists don't talk to each other, you get a very nice chair facing a blank wall.
Let's get specific about what happens when they don't coordinate. Give me a case study.
The classic American suburb is the perfect disaster of uncoordinated design. Architects designed individual houses, many of them quite beautiful, thoughtfully laid out, good daylight, nice proportions. but planners imposed single-use zoning that separated residential from commercial and minimum parking requirements that made everything car-dependent. The result is beautiful houses in unwalkable, isolating environments. The architecture is good. The planning is bad. And the human outcome is worse than either would be alone.
The houses are ergonomic chairs, arranged in a room where you can't reach any of them without driving.
Now contrast that with Barcelona's Aixample district. Ildefons Cerdà designed the block structure in the 1850s, the famous octagonal blocks with chamfered corners, wide streets, interior courtyards. The planners set the framework. Then architects filled it in over the next century and a half with buildings that respond to that framework. The result is a walkable, mixed-use urban fabric that neither the planner nor any individual architect could have achieved alone.
Cerdà was an engineer, not an architect, which might explain why he approached it as a systems problem.
He was obsessed with public health. He studied ventilation, sunlight access, population density. He was doing ergonomics at city scale before anyone used that word. The chamfered corners on the Aixample blocks, those octagonal intersections, weren't an aesthetic choice. They were for visibility and air circulation.
The coordination mechanism there was the block structure. The planner designed the container, and architects designed what went inside it. What are the modern versions of that?
A few things. Form-based codes are the big one. Traditional zoning is use-based. It says this zone is for residential, this zone is for commercial, this zone is for industrial. Form-based codes regulate building shape and street interaction instead. They say your building must be between 3 and 6 stories, the ground floor must be transparent glass, the entrance must face the street, the setback is 0 to 5 feet. That's a planning tool that directly shapes architecture.
Instead of saying, you can put a store here, it says whatever you put here has to meet the street in a particular way.
And Portland, Oregon was an early adopter of this thinking. They established an urban growth boundary in 1979, one of the first in the U.S. That forced architects to design denser, transit-oriented buildings because the land supply was constrained. A planning decision reshaped architectural practice for an entire region.
Design review boards are another bridging mechanism, right?
Yes, though they're controversial. The idea is that a panel reviews proposed buildings for how they contribute to the public realm. Not just whether they meet code, but whether the ground floor is active, whether the massing fits the street, whether the materials contribute to the neighborhood's character. Architects often hate them because they add uncertainty and cost. Planners often love them because they're one of the few tools that let planning influence architecture after zoning is set.
I can see both sides. It's the difference between meet these objective criteria and convince a committee that your design is good. One is predictable, the other is a vibe check.
The vibe check of urban governance. But when design review works well, it forces the conversation that should have happened during zoning. It makes the architect think about the street, not just the parcel. I've sat in design review sessions where an architect came in with a beautiful building that had a blank concrete wall facing the main pedestrian street, and the board asked one question. What does someone walking past this wall experience for 200 feet? And the architect had no answer. That's the coordination gap made visible.
That's a conversation that should have happened in week one of the design process, not at the public hearing 6 months in.
But the system isn't set up for that. The planner zones it, the architect designs it, and they meet for the first time when the drawings are already done. It's like writing a novel and then finding out what genre it's supposed to be.
Let's go back to something Daniel asked. What are some ways architects bring value to urban spaces that don't involve designing buildings at all?
John Gehl is the perfect example. Gehl is a Danish architect who basically invented the modern study of pedestrian behavior. Starting in the 1960s, he spent years in Copenhagen just watching how people use streets and public spaces, where they walked, where they stopped, where they sat, what made them linger versus hurry through. He didn't design buildings. He designed the space between them.
The ergonomics of the street.
And his work convinced Copenhagen to pedestrianize Strøget, the main shopping street, in 1962. At the time, people said it would kill business, that Danes needed their cars, that the climate was wrong. Instead, it became one of the most successful public spaces in Europe. Gehl's insight was that if you design the street for pedestrians, wide sidewalks, places to sit, protection from wind, people will use it regardless of the weather. He was doing exactly what an ergonomist does, studying human behavior and designing the environment to fit it.
He wasn't drawing building elevations. He was drawing desire lines.
Desire paths are actually a great example of this. You know what a desire path is?
The dirt trail that cuts across the grass where the sidewalk should have been.
Desire paths are informal trails that reveal where people actually want to walk, versus where planners and architects put the paved routes. They're the landscape's way of saying your design was wrong, and good architects study them obsessively. There's a famous campus planning story, I think it was Ohio State, where the designers waited a full year after construction to see where the desire paths appeared and then paved those.
That's user research. That's A/B testing. That's not what most people imagine when they picture an architect at work.
It should be. And the best architects do this instinctively. They think about what Oscar Neumann called defensible space. Neumann published his theory in 1972, and it's one of the most important ideas in the overlap between architecture and planning. He showed that architectural features, things like windows overlooking parking lots, semi-private courtyards, clear territorial boundaries between public and private space, could reduce crime by up to 50% in public housing projects.
Not through policing, not through social programs, through window placement and courtyard design.
Do what Neumann called natural surveillance. If a potential offender feels seen, they're less likely to act. A window that faces the street isn't just a source of daylight, it's a crime prevention tool. And that's pure ergonomics, designing the environment to shape behavior without the occupant ever consciously noticing.
This is where the conversation gets radical. Most people think crime prevention is cops and cameras. Architecture is doing it with sight lines and semi-private courtyards and the difference between a stoop and a lobby.
It works at the other end of the behavioral spectrum, too. Museum fatigue is a well-documented phenomenon. Visitors start tuning out after about 45 minutes, regardless of how interested they are. Good museum architecture designs circulation paths that give you moments of rest, varied ceiling heights, views to the outside. The Guggenheim spiral ramp isn't just a sculptural gesture, it's an ergonomic solution to the fatigue problem. You never have to decide where to go next, the building decides for you.
The building is the interface, and a bad interface exhausts you whether you realize it or not.
There's a term for this in architecture, environmental psychology. It's the study of how built spaces affect mood, cognition, social behavior, and it's been around for decades, but the profession rarely leads with it publicly. The public face is still the hero shot of the facade at golden hour.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
I don't even know what that means, but I'm going to accept it.
If architecture and planning are two scales of the same ergonomic problem, what does that mean for how we should think about the built environment? Let's pull this together.
It means the boundary between the two fields isn't just fuzzy, it's actively harmful when treated as a hard line. When architects design to the property edge and planners design to the street center line and they don't talk, you get exactly the kind of built environment most people complain about. Buildings that turn their backs to the street, plazas nobody uses, neighborhoods where you can't walk to get a coffee.
The coordination gap is the root cause of a lot of bad urbanism.
Bridging it requires both fields to expand their scope. Architects need to think beyond the property line. What does this building do to the street, to the block, to the neighborhood? Planners need to think at finer grain. What will this zoning code actually produce when an architect sits down to design within it? The best outcomes happen when both scales are designed together.
Which brings us to what Daniel was really asking. Is it fair to call architects ergonomists?
I think it's not only fair, it's clarifying. It reframes the entire profession around outcomes instead of outputs. An architect who thinks of herself as an ergonomist is asking, what does this space do for the people in it? Not, how does this building photograph? And that shift changes everything, from how clients brief projects to how cities evaluate proposals.
The chair designer and the city planner are doing the same kind of work at different magnifications. One's adjusting lumbar support, the other's adjusting block dimensions. Both are asking what makes a human body comfortable in this environment.
The tools are different. An ergonomist uses anthropometric data and pressure mapping. An architect uses daylight simulation and circulation analysis. A planner uses demographic projections and traffic modeling. But the underlying question is identical. How do we design this thing so that humans thrive in it?
What about the objection that this framing is too reductive? Someone could reasonably say, You're describing architecture as if it's just a technical optimization problem. Where's the soul? Where's the beauty?
That's a fair pushback, and I'm not arguing that architecture is only ergonomics. I'm arguing that ergonomics is the foundation, and the profession has done itself a disservice by hiding the foundation and only showing the ornament. A building can be stunningly beautiful and also functionally hostile. And when that happens, the beauty doesn't save it. People don't say this office gives me headaches from the glare, but the facade is exquisite, so I'll stay.
The ergonomics is the floor. The aesthetics is the ceiling. You need both, but if the floor is missing, nobody's standing around admiring the ceiling. They've already fallen through.
And what's interesting is that some of the most beloved buildings in the world nail both. The Pantheon in Rome is an ergonomic masterpiece. The oculus provides natural light that tracks across the interior across the day. The proportions create acoustic clarity without amplification. The thermal mass stabilizes temperature. But nobody visits the Pantheon thinking great thermal mass. They feel it. The ergonomics delivers the experience and the aesthetics make it memorable.
Let's get practical. For someone listening to this who's not an architect or a planner, what should they actually do with this information?
First, when you're evaluating a building or a public space, ask, what does this space do for the people in it? Not, does it look good? Shift from aesthetic criteria to ergonomic criteria. Does this plaza have places to sit? Does this street feel safe to walk down? Does this lobby make you want to enter the building or hurry past it?
The aesthetic question is easier to ask, which is why it dominates. Do I like how this looks? Is a one-second judgment. What does this space do? Requires paying attention.
Second, if you're involved in local development decisions, or even just voting on them, push for form-based codes and design review processes that require architects and planners to coordinate early. Not sequential approvals, where the planner zones it and the architect designs it, and they meet for the first time at the Planning Commission hearing. That's how you get death by a thousand cuts.
Third, the next time someone says, architects just make pretty buildings, you now have a reply. Architects engineer human experience at the scale of rooms and buildings. Planners do it at the scale of neighborhoods and cities. Both are ergonomists. The difference is magnification, not category.
If you want to go deeper, look up your own city's zoning code. Is it use-based, separating residential from commercial, or form-based, regulating building shape and street interaction? The former creates the coordination gap we've been talking about. The latter bridges it. That one distinction explains more about why your city looks the way it does than almost anything else.
Most people have never looked at their city's zoning code, which is understandable. But it's the operating system your built environment runs on.
It's probably running on something designed in the 1950s.
Here's a thing I keep coming back to. Daniel mentioned Hannah's interest in urban planning, and you can hear him trying to map the boundary between what she does and what planners do. But I wonder if the real insight here is that the boundary is a historical accident. Architecture and planning weren't always separate professions. The people who designed cities also designed the buildings in them for most of human history.
That's absolutely right. The separation is a 20th century invention, driven by specialization and the sheer scale of modern cities. Before that, you had figures like Christopher Wren, architect of St. Sirection, Paul's Cathedral, who also proposed a comprehensive plan for rebuilding London after the Great Fire of 1666. He didn't see a bright line between building and city.
Now we're seeing a return to that integrated model. Firms like Bjarke Ingels Group and MVRDV operate at both building and city scale. They'll design a single building and then also do the master plan for an entire district. The boundary is dissolving again.
Partly because the tools are making it possible. Parametric design software lets you model an entire neighborhood and zoom down to a single doorknob in the same file. The technology is erasing the distinction that the profession's built.
Which raises an open question. As AI and generative design tools become more common, tools that can automatically generate floor plans, optimize for circulation, daylight, and energy performance, will the ergonomic function of architecture become automated? Will we feed constraints into a model and get back a building that works perfectly for humans? No architect required.
I think the human judgment of spatial experience remains irreplaceable, at least for now. A computer can optimize a floor plan for walking distance. It can't tell you whether a room feels welcoming. It can't make the creative leap from this neighborhood needs more eyes on the street to let's put a cafe here with a specific kind of seating that invites lingering. The ergonomic metrics are necessary but not sufficient. Architecture is also about meaning, memory, delight.
The computer can design the ergonomic chair. It can't decide whether the chair should exist in the first place or what kind of room it belongs in.
That's where the architect as ergonomist plus something else lives. The something else is harder to define, which is why the profession defaults to, we make pretty buildings. It's easier to sell beauty than to sell the ineffable quality of spatial experience.
Selling the ineffable is a tough business model.
Always has been. But the ones who do it well, the Jan Gehls, the Christopher Alexanders, the firms that operate at both scales, they're not selling ineffability, they're selling outcomes. Buildings that make you feel something. The ergonomics gets you the baseline, the art gets you the rest.
The next time you walk through a city, notice the seams, where a building meets the sidewalk, where a plaza meets a street, where a courtyard opens to a public path. Those seams are where architecture and planning negotiate. Pay attention to who designed them, and whether anyone designed them at all.
If you find a good seam, stop and appreciate it. Someone fought for that.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1720s, Turkmen nomads used a specific camel hair lashing called the sirkek to bind yurt frames. The lashing's natural linoleum content acted as a waterproofing agent, while the fiber's high keratin proportion resisted rot in the steppe's wet-dry cycles, essentially creating a self-preserving structural joint.
Right? This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor. Leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It actually helps. Find us at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.